Hey, I'm Steve Stevens, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room today is a guitarist and a songwriter with quite an eclectic resume. And if you only know him as the Keith Richards to Billy Idol's Mick Jagger, then I hope to change that today. So please welcome to the Zoom room, Mr. Steve Stevens. Hey, Steve, how you doing?
Great. My pleasure.
So, Steve, you're still in quarantine like we all are. You're staying inside.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, fortunately, Billy and myself did quarantine and did tests and all that. So we're able to continue to write and record and basically do what we ordinarily do anyway. So, but other than that, we're locked away, you know?
Yeah. That's how it is with everyone. Now you brought this up really quickly. That was one of the things on my list. There was a tweet just the other day. Billy, put it out there that you guys are working on new Billy Idol music.
Yeah, we finished, doing live shows in March, just when COVID hit, and we kind of did the quarantine thing, and then we said, all right, well, what do we do now? So we had already been in talks with producer Butch Walker to do some stuff, and Butch is like a one man army. He has his own studio and engineers everything, and So he also had been quarantined. So, the three of us got together and we amassed a bunch of songs and we hope to have it out, at some point. Not sure about this year, but early next year, maybe.
Yeah, hopefully, next year, and then you guys, it'll be safe to tour again because, you put a new album out there, then you want to play it live.
Absolutely.
Now, this is exciting because Steve Stevens, Billy Idol, and Butch Walker. This just sounds like something everyone's going to want to hear. I mean, that sounds like an amazing combination.
Yeah, I hunted Butch down. I befriended him first. Actually, someone told me that he owned a Steve Stevens Hamer guitar from the 80s.
Wow.
And I said, oh, there's my in. So I tweeted him. I said, hey, word on the street is you owned one of my guitars. And then we started a dialogue. And I said, it'd be great for you. You'd be the perfect producer for Billy Idol because he's got one foot in the traditional rock world,
right,
as he started, but also, his records are very contemporary, and I thought he'd really get what we were about and also where we could go in the future while still keeping a Billy Idol traditional thing. And it's worked out great. He's been absolute pleasure to work with.
It's been about 6 years since you guys recorded an album, a Billy Idol album, 2014's Kings and Queens of the Underground. And that album, when I opened up the liner notes to that and saw that Trevor Horn produced that, that seemed kind of out of your wheelhouse to work with Trevor Horn. And I love that album so much. You guys killed it on that record.
Riding down this road like I've ridden down a million, run through every roadblock in this town. I laughed at all the signs that say speed will kill you. It took you to slow me down. I'd forgotten how to fly. I'll remember before I die. It's a crooked line. Road I ride. It's a bitter pill
great. I mean, that's, I mean, you know, you talk about the list of dream producers, and Trevor's name is in there. And it was such a great experience for Billy and I, because we had never recorded in England, and Trevor's studio, it's no longer around now, but we were actually the last artist to work at SARM, which was his studio. But then I found out that SARM was Island Studios, which was where some of the Led Zeppelin stuff was recorded, all the Traffic stuff, classic Genesis. So Trevor, you know, I grew up on a lot of the early prog stuff. So Trevor and I, you know, were like, you know, all these exchange stories about Yes and all this kind of stuff. Once again, you know, you always hope that, you know, the collaboration will work.
Right.
But you never know. But you know, once again, you know, just a fantastic experience.
As a musician, when you go to these studios, these classic studios, like my background is stand-up comedy. So when I moved to Los Angeles and the first time I set foot in the Comedy Store, that just felt like incredible. So is that the same feeling you guys have?
Yeah. I mean, these studios are disappearing. You know, as I said, we were the last artist in there. It's now condominiums.
Wow. So, what a waste.
Know, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's the good side of it, which is, I can do records at home.
That's true.
But also there is that thrill of being in a classic studio. You know, when people ask me about Rebel Yell, I say, you know, we were locked away for 10 months at Electric Lady Studios. How could we not come up with
exactly
something brilliant, you know? And, you know, fortunately in Los Angeles, there are still some of these great studios. And, you know, if you're a rock and roll band, you've got to get in a big room and record drums properly and cut. You want to try and cut your tracks, you know, as a band to get that chemistry. With a lot of, you know, hip hop and other kinds of music, it's not that important. You can do it on a laptop. But I think for rock and roll.
Right. For rock and roll.
For rock and roll, there's nothing better than being in a big room.
I didn't expect that we would jump to Kings and Queens of the Underground this quickly. But again, this was a great album. You guys played like 40 dates or more live to tour on this thing. And you and Billy, you co-wrote 7 of the 11 songs. And that for me is great, because when you two write together, I love it. I mean, just like the Rebel Yell album. I mean, you guys pretty much wrote that whole thing, I think, but one. So that's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of those weird guitar players who doesn't see, when I'm working with people, I really don't see myself as a guitar player. I try and use my instrument to move the song forward and tell a story, mm-hmm. you know, and reflect the lyrics and the vibe and the environment of the song. So I think that served me well as a co-writer, because I think the people that I work with, the singers, know I'm not trying to put an agenda about my guitar playing into the project. I'm trying to just get the best song out of it. You know, here we are, you know, Billy and I have worked together for 38 years, and there's still some fruits in the there's still some cookies in the cookie jar, you know?
Well, one of my favorite songs off of that album was Postcards from the Past. I mean, that just, it's a killer. I love it. It just kicks ass.
To find my destination, you touch my fascination once again.
That record was the quickest thing we had ever done. I think it was 2 weeks to do the record. Obviously, the writing process was longer than that. But the actual recording, once we got to London, we were there for about 2 weeks and cut it pretty quickly.
it's exciting for me when there's a new album with you two guys, because it's, you know, there's a long duration now between the albums because you guys go out and tour and stuff. But but when they drop, I'm all in. I love it.
Oh, great.
So you guys, and you guys haven't disappointed for the past two albums. Just great stuff. But I want to hit on some things. I want to make sure I get this stuff out there. I want people to know that you're finally getting into the social media. You got a brand new website, stevestevensguitar.com.
Right.
So that's where we can go to find out all things about Steve Stevens.
Yeah, and I'm pretty active on Instagram and Facebook, and I do answer fans' questions, especially guitar players, when they have technical questions, because, man, I would have given anything as a kid to, you know, to pose a question to Jimmy Page or somebody. And I think it's important to have, you know, an open dialogue. You know, that's what the internet is there for. So, if people want to contact
me, that's pretty cool.
Obviously all the projects and business stuff, whatever, merch and all that's based on the
right.
website.
Sure.
But yeah, if you catch me on Instagram, and now I have a Twitter, and I try and stay active and engaged with people.
Twitter is at Steve Stevens. And you're also on Cameo, cameo.com/ Steve Stevens a go-go.
Right. Yeah. So, we have been doing cameos, and, you know, it's great because people are, you know, I'm not doing guitar lessons on there. I'm
right.
doing greetings. But if someone has a question about a recording or a guitar part, I'll show it, you know, and explain what it's about. There's no secrets with, you know, with that stuff. I don't mind it.
Born in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I was actually born in, I lived in Brownsville when I was a kid, which mm-hmm. is where Mike Tyson and Riddick Bowe were from.
Wow.
If that tells you anything. but my parents moved to Rockaway when I was about 2 years old, which is part of Queens, New York, but I could have literally walked to Long Island from where I was. We're right on the border between Queens and Long Island.
And how long have you been in Los Angeles now? How long have you lived out here?
25 years.
So do you feel like do you still feel like a New Yorker, or are you a West Coast guy? How do you feel?
I New York has changed so much since when I lived there. I went to high school in Manhattan, and from that point on, I lived in Manhattan, during the 70s, which was, if you've ever seen Taxi Driver, that was our existence. I mean, it really was like, like that, dangerous, but really exciting. And at the time that I was living in Manhattan, there was so much music happening, and all these bands were getting signed out of clubs and CBGBs and all that stuff. But now, when you know, New York is become like the rest of the world. It's pretty gentrified.
Yeah, sure.
So when I go to New York now, I do all the silly things I used to make fun of people for doing. You know, I do all the tourist things.
Right. At what age does Steve Stevens pick up a guitar?
Really early. I didn't pick up the guitar per se. My dad, who was had a great record collection, but there was no musicians in my family.
Yeah.
He bought, I believe it was for $17, he got a Burl Ives music songbook and a guitar. And he brought it home. It's kind of a toy.
Yeah. You know?
But it played, and he brought it home for himself. But, you know, he was a hardworking blue-collar guy. He didn't have time for this. By the time he had dinner, he was out. So
he was,
the guitar ended up in my room. And my brother had older friends. I have my older brother's 5 years older than me, and a lot of his friends played. You know, they said to my mom, you know, he's making a hell of a racket, but it's in time. So she said, well, I guess I have to live with that racket, so might as well get him some lessons. So my first guitar teacher was, there was a protest singer from the 60s named Phil Oakes, and his sister was my first guitar teacher.
Nice.
So I started on, this was when, you know, all the folk guitar stuff was happening, mm-hmm. like James Taylor and Joni Mitchell and Crosby, Stills, Nash.
Great stuff.
So as a, you know, as a kid having an acoustic guitar, it was great. to learn all that stuff, and you could, and of course the Beatles catalog. Every kid back then learned Beatles music.
Yeah, I rarely interview anyone that doesn't mention the Beatles. I mean, it's just it's how it is. It's music.
Yeah, it's funny because I for a while thought, well, that's my generation. We grew up on that. But younger guitar players that I speak to are learning Beatles tunes as well. I guess, you know, they really are a timeless, you know, thing that, you know, people recognize their music was so great and so harmonically rich. Doesn't matter what year they came out, you know.
Yeah. When you're playing an acoustic guitar, you don't really develop your own sound on an acoustic guitar. But then when you move to electric, that's when you can really branch out. And there's a lot of guitarists that have their own sound, obviously Eddie Van Halen and Brian May. And I feel like you're one of those guys, because whenever I hear you on a record, even if I don't know you played on that record, it'll be like, wait a minute, I think that's Steve Stevens. And then you look through the liner notes and sure enough, there it is. So yeah, when did you, so first of all, that's congratulations on that. That's something to be proud of when you have your own distinct thing that you do. And when did that develop? When did you move from acoustic to electric?
Wow. I played acoustic from the time I was, I mean, properly, I'd say 7 and a half. And I got an electric guitar when I was 13. Mm-hmm. So I think the acoustic background kind of, it enhanced my playing when I got an electric. I think if I had started on electric, I'd be a totally different guitar player. Yeah. But I understood the importance of rhythm guitar, and still to this day, my favorite guitar players are still primarily rhythm guys. But the stylistic, signature thing, I think that really was just it's a lot of it is what records you listen to.
Right. And
I never particularly, I was really fortunate that when I got an electric guitar, there was the height of the English guitar hero thing. Obviously, you know, Hendrix was part of that. And, but then you had Brian May, Jeff Beck, and all of the early English progressive rock guitar players like Robert Fripp from King Crimson,
right,
Steve Hackett, Steve Howe from Yes. And these were guitar players that were using all these different styles rather than like an Eric Clapton, who's blues-based, brilliant, but primarily has one guitar sound or one track that goes through the song. These were guys that were arranging their guitars. Oh, let's put a little bit of classical guitar in the verse, and then when the chorus comes, let's put a fuzz guitar. And I approached music like that, so when it came time to work with Billy Idol, that served me really well, to kind of almost, you know, be a bit of a director, you know, like, look at the song as the film and paint with these colors and enhance it in that way. And I think that gave me and helped give me an identifiable guitar style. And obviously, with Billy, it was amalgamation of the energy of punk rock and the aggression of things like the Pistols and the Ramones and then also things like Susie and the Banshees, but also with the technical ability of some of my prog rock heroes. So it's like this gumbo you mix up, and that's what I am.
That's what you are. When did you and Billy first get together? I mean, you're from totally different backgrounds, but maybe different, but maybe the same. I don't know. Did you guys hit it off immediately?
Not necessarily. It wasn't like we got together and we both started talking about, you know, tracks off, you know, records. It was interesting when I met Billy. You know, he's a huge reggae fan, right? And a fan of dub style, you know, these kind of dance remixes, reggae's use of effects and echoes and things like that. And you can hear that on the Third Generation X record. There's a lot of that reggae dub stuff. So I was interested in that because I knew nothing about it. And then obviously he's from London, 1977. So those bands really were rebelling against a lot of the heroes, you know, certainly the end of the prog rock stuff, which had become really kind of over the top.
Right.
You know, wasn't. And you combine in England, it was part of a socioeconomic movement, whereas punk really wasn't that in New York. It was a totally different thing. What really bonded us was he loved things like Lou Reed and maybe early T-Rex and glam rock, things like Sweet. And, you know, that's where we found common ground in that. And I knew all the Lou Reed stuff. And, just about any band that came from New York, you know, one of my first managers was the co-manager of the New York Dolls and had a lot of doll stories and stuff. And Sylvain actually named me. He came to my band's rehearsal and I was looking for a last name.
A new moniker. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And he said, well, do what I do. Just use your first name twice.
Steve Stevens.
So I said, duh. Okay. You know, when a member of the New York Dolls, it's like being knighted.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I'll take that advice.
He christened you Steve Stevens.
He did.
Well, it's easy to remember.
Yeah.
You don't forget Steve Stevens and you don't forget Billy Idol. I mean, you just don't forget those names.
Yeah. So that's the stuff we found common ground in. And then when we actually sat down, because we pretty much, I said, look, you know, you want to put a band together. I know every musician in New York. So let me help you put a band together. And I don't know if they auditioned guitar players. Maybe they checked a couple of people out. Uh-huh. But, you know, I said, you know, when it comes time for guitar, I hope you consider me, you know. And it was really just
just casual.
It was pretty much just a hang, you know.
Yeah.
It was this guy who had, you know, moved to New York from England. It was soon after John Lennon was shot. So I could imagine, you know, we talked about that. He's thinking, what the hell have I gotten myself into, you know? But he loved New York, and what I soon realized was there was a really cool contingent of English musicians that Billy was all friends with that had moved to New York, and it was a cool little scene.
Yeah, that's cool. Definitely.
Yeah.
So the first album that you guys do together comes out in 1982. It goes gold. What's that like? I mean, was that the first professional recording that you had done at that point?
It was it was the first one that saw the light of day.
Well, okay. But you had been in studios and you had recorded stuff. It just wasn't, it just wasn't as well known. This was your first taste of some success.
I mean, the interesting thing is the album didn't go gold when it was released. It went gold
eventually.
After Rebel Yell.
Ah, okay. People went back and said, there's another album. Let's listen to this.
That's right. Although White Wedding and Dancing With Myself are on the first album, they did well as singles.
Yeah.
But the album wasn't a massive seller. And I remember that first tour was pretty brutal. Even though I was 22 years old, you're pretty resilient then, but in the dead of winter up in Canada, in a van that's breaking down.
And, yeah.
It was tough, man. It was really, you know, it was grueling. And bands are still doing it that way.
Right.
Well, we were.
Yeah.
But,
So at that point, you're not traveling A-list, you know, it's,
not at all.
You're just getting to the gig and, hoping that there's some cold pizza.
Yeah, exactly. Basically. Yeah. But, you know, you get the adrenaline that you get from playing, something that you've created for me to finally play in front of an audience that, that knew my tracks on the record, you know, that had bought the record, knew the guitar parts, and to see even one or two guys in the audience, you know, miming the guitar.
that must be cool.
That's all I needed, you know.
That keeps you going. That's the adrenaline.
That's all I needed. So, like I said, we're pretty young, you know, just happy to be doing it.
And, you got two co-writes on that album and the album kicks off with a song I love. Come on, come on. So good.
I'm
Yeah, I think that was the first song we ever wrote together.
And it made it to the album. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So then you're beating around with this first album. You're touring, like you said. It's not first class all the way. But then Rebel Yell comes out, and this thing's a monster.
Right.
I mean, there's, people worry about the sophomore slump. That did not happen with you guys.
Yeah, I mean, the last song that was written for the first album was White Wedding, because we needed a single. Basically, our producer locked Billy away in the studio, wouldn't let him out. And I remember we recorded that album in Los Angeles, and we were staying at the Sunset Marquee. Mm-hmm. About 9 in the morning, knock on my hotel door, and it's Billy, and he's got the ghetto blaster, and puts in the cassette, and he goes, "I think I got one."
Wow.
And from the moment I heard it, I mean, his original demo was pretty close to the recorded mm-hmm. version, with all that kind of spaghetti Western guitar style. And, so when it came time to do Rebel Yell, we knew that was the bar. You know, we had to start where we left off.
With White Wedding.
Right. So Rebel Yell was kind of like the next level starting point for that record. And
last night, dancer came dancing to my door. Last night, a little angel came pumping on my floor. She said, "Come, baby, got a license for love. And if it expires, pray help from above." Because in the midnight hour, she cried,
and then we took some risks, Eyes Without a Face. Can we get away with a ballad? Yeah, sure,
I'm born out of home. One more bad break could bring a fall. When I'm far from home, don't call me on the phone to tell me all.
What's great about Billy Idol Records is every song can be a little bit different.
Mm-hmm, right.
There's no formula. And that's something that I think came from both of us growing up with Beatles records, because every song on a Beatles record is a different style, or, you know, they take you on a little right. journey.
Yeah, I mean, if you grow up just listening to Led Zeppelin, then you're probably just going to play songs like Led Zeppelin. But if you have a nice eclectic musical library at your disposal, then you're good to go. Longevity.
Well, I mean, Led Zeppelin, pretty diverse.
Well, you know, yeah, that's true.
You know, I mean,
that's just the first example that came to my head, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the first album was more in that formula,
right.
blues-based thing, but certainly by the time they got to Houses of the Holy, and, you know, each song, you know, you had a 12-string raga Indian thing, and
yeah.
then a blues thing. So,
well, I'm mad at myself, Steve, now that I used Led Zeppelin as the example. I mean, I'm pissed off, but...
But I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Van Halen is a band who, you know, Ed, he's so brilliant, he doesn't need to layer his guitars. Mm-hmm. That's the thing about Van Halen. You capture that live performance, and pretty much it's that way through the whole record. It's, we're certainly not that kind of thing. We definitely use the studio as a creative tool.
You guys have never released a live album, a live Billy Idol?
We have. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, how come I don't know about this then?
Well, it was done limited edition on vinyl.
Okay, that's fine.
There's not that many. It was a 3-album set.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, 3-vinyl set, and it's actually really good. We really made sure we got good performances, you know.
And what year was this done?
This came out, maybe 3 years ago or so.
I got to seek this thing out now. This is crazy that I don't know about this.
There's a live DVD from Chicago.
Alrighty.
That's got to be about 10 years old now. Yeah.
Is that you in the White Wedding video with the doctor with the mask on?
It's not.
That's not. You're not in the video, but there's a guy with black hair that's kind of got spiky hair. And I was like, is that Steve? But he's wearing a mask. So I couldn't tell if it was you.
That's actually was Billy's best friend, Mark, at
okay.
the time, who's about 6'2". So it's definitely not me. Yeah. But those are all, you know, all the people in that video were, all friends of Billy and his girlfriend at the time, mm-hmm. Perry, you know.
Perry. And you mentioned Eyes Without a Face. That goes to number 4. You guys must have been through the moon.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, when we were doing Rebel Yell, we'd have these end of the week playbacks where we'd invite friends, mm-hmm. Friday night, and people would come by. And it was really obvious we had something really, really good.
That's cool.
You know, I tell people, you know, when sometimes... You know, when you write songs and you get the right musicians together, there's something else happening. There's some other mojo or God or whoever or wherever, whatever entity or higher power or whatever you want to call it is part of the process. And we certainly had, you know, some help on that record because...
Yeah.
Things just worked. Every guitar idea I could think of worked against the tracks. And, you know, we were actually doing the record and we were looking for a drummer. Mm-hmm. We weren't getting the right drum tracks. And lo and behold, Tommy Price, was the drummer in Scandal at
yep.
the time. And they
love that
they
guy.
Recording, yeah. And they were recording down the hall. And we heard through the wall. We go, that guy sounds really good. You know, all right, who's going to get him? And it turned out, you know, he's a big part of that record. Those drums are great on that.
Yeah, I mean, I love him on the Joan Jett albums that he plays on, too. I mean, he's just,
exactly.
you know, I hate myself for loving you. The guy's just a monster on the kit.
And he came from the, you know, Mink DeVille, Willie DeVille and all that stuff. And he was definitely a guy who understood immediately what the music needed.
The thing about Rebel Yell is even though all the songs on the album aren't singles, when you listen to that album, it feels like you're almost listening to a greatest hits album because every track is just amazing.
Thanks. I mean, it was the first record where the attention to detail was like, you know, we put every note and every word and every aspect of the music under the mm-hmm. microscope. We really were like, why am I playing this? You know, just because, that chord goes next to that. Oh, what's the reason, you know?
Yeah.
And it came down to really the attention to detail. And once again, you know, our producer, Keith Forsey, was really guided us and really made that album. You know, there wouldn't be a Rebel Yell album without Keith Forsey.
I want to move on from the Billy Idol stuff because I don't want to just talk about, because you've done so much other stuff. But I do want to say that then you guys do Whiplash Smile in 1986. And then after that, you guys part ways for a while. And was that, were you guys no longer friends at that point? Did you just not want to work together? Was it like a divorce? I don't want to, and again, Steve, I don't want to get into drama either. That's not my thing.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, there was no slagging or any of that stuff, okay. which wasn't the kind of relationship we
cool.
had.
Okay, good.
Anyway, Billy made a decision to move to Los Angeles. I wanted to stay in New York. And Whiplash Smile was a tough record to do. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no live drums, no real bass on it. And as a guitar player, I found it really hard to make my guitar stick.
Yeah.
To it. You know, now I can appreciate it, but at the time of recording it, it was pretty tough. And I was offered a deal over at Warner Brothers, Ted Templeman, who was head of A&R and also Van Halen's producer, came a knocking and we became friends. And then I said I'd do a record for them. And but yeah, I mean, you know, it was understood that I was going to do my thing. I wished Billy well and
cool.
And it was kind of like, I'll see you down the road, you know? And so when we got back together, we didn't have to make amends or
that's great.
No apologies. It was just, you know,
you're working together again. Great.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You're talking about Atomic Playboys is the album that you made for Warner Brothers.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
And, sadly, I just saw one of your posts that the keyboardist from this album just passed away. So sorry to hear that.
Yeah. Sweet, sweet, sweetheart of a guy. And this is before we had laptop computers and stuff. And he taught me a lot about how you do computer sequencing. And he worked with everyone, Blondie, Debbie Harry, you know. I mean, he was a real New York fixture, studio fixture, sweetest guy. And he came out. He was the keyboard player, came out on the road. So, I was very sad to hear that.
And what we say here when someone passes, we say rock and peace. So rock and peace, Phil Ashley, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
The title track, Atomic Playboys, has some amazing guitar on it. So, so good. I mean, that kicks off the album just the right way. That sets the tone for what we're going to hear on this thing.
I mean, it was pretty much it was more of a hard rock record than the Billy Idol stuff. The only problem for me was by then I was used to a level of luxury.
Right. And now you're starting at ground zero again, so you're probably, did you guys tour with this album?
We did.
And you're not playing the venues that you just were playing with the big top 40 hits and stuff.
Right. And but I'm still in my mind like, well, I deserve two tour buses.
Sure.
I deserve. And it was a very expensive record to do. Naively, the record company's like shelling out money for, $300,000, $400,000 videos and all. Wow, that's my money?
Yeah.
You learn that later on, you know.
Well, I mean, no offense to Chrysalis Records, but Warner Brothers Records is a bigger company than Chrysalis was. I mean,
and you know, all respect to Warner's, they treated me fantastic, and getting to know Ted Templeman, you know, the thing about my relationship with Warner Brothers is that Ted was the one that got me the Michael mm-hmm. Jackson gig. Ted was the one that put me together with Vince Neil. And so there were other things.
There were other things that came from this relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was very, my relationship with Warner's was a good thing.
You brought up Michael Jackson in 2020 for me personally, Steve. It's a difficult artist to talk about. So, yeah. But Dirty Diana, it's just amazing. I watched the video the other day, and it's, you know, you guys look so cool together on stage, and you are just killing it. What was that? What was that like when you got the call to do that? Because I mean, he was doing that, you know, he used Eddie on Beat It, and then he used you, and then he did Slash, and, you know, getting some rock cred from bringing you guys into these records. But the songs that the three of you played on are undeniably, they're classics. When you get the call back then, you're totally on board immediately, I would assume.
Yeah, I mean, I got a call from Quincy Jones, but, you know, Ted Templeman didn't tell me that he had spoken to Quincy. Quincy mm-hmm. actually called Ted and said, hey, man, you know, we're working on the follow-up to Thriller. We've got another rock track, and it worked out so great for us with Eddie. Who's a new guy, you know, who we need another gunslinger.
I was going to say gunslinger.
Yeah. So fortunately, Ted threw my name in there, and Quincy actually remembered me, because when we did Billy's first record, we were down the hall and Michael was doing Off the Wall. Mm-hmm. And so we'd pass each other in the hallway over at Westlake Studios. So Quincy was aware and said, I got your number from Ted Templeman, and how'd you like to work on the record? Sure. I mean, and obviously this was, you know, pre all of the
stuff. Yeah, you don't know. Stuff, yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, yeah. So you're going in, and it's Michael Jackson. It's the biggest artist in the world, and you're going to go work with him.
So I was still living in New York. I flew to Los Angeles to do the session, and I'm expecting this massive entourage, and you know, I really hadn't done that many sessions outside of Idol.
Right.
I was a little nervous, like, you know, what's it going to be like? All these people, monkeys, and all this. You know, and I open the studio door, and it's just Michael, Quincy, and engineer Bruce. That was it.
That was it. You know,
and and the way that they worked was very similar to how we worked, and it was, you know, recording was really cool. It was, you know, exactly how I would have hoped it would have been.
And now the outward thing from Michael Jackson, he always seems like he's shy and everything, but behind closed doors, when you guys are working on this track, he obviously isn't that way, right? You guys are just talking music and.
I mean, he is, you know, it was obvious that him and Quincy had a great communication.
Okay.
And I'm sure that they had spoken before the session about what they were trying to get for the song. You know, I mean, the last thing that I needed was, you know, somebody sticking music paper in front of me and going, well, here's the chart.
Gotcha.
And Michael is not that guy. So he would go, he'd sing me the melody or, you know, okay, this let's. And of course, you know, we captured all the things that they needed and that probably took about an hour or so. And then they said, do whatever you want to do. And the version of the song that I played on was almost 8 minutes. And then they edited it down. So I was able to like give them all these alternative bits and sounds and effects and all this kind of stuff. So it was very much the way I was used to working.
So did you play on the whole song? Because when I look up credits, it just says like solo Steve Stevens, but you played on the whole song.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And then you get to be, they ask you to be in the video, which is massive.
Yeah. The power that video, because I was, you know, I was used to the success of the Billy Idol videos, which would premiere on MTV or whatever. But this was on a whole different level. I was living in New York and it premiered on like Entertainment Tonight and, you know, major network things. So the next day I go out, I'm going to go out for my coffee and bagel, you know, and I'm walking down the street and I pass by a McDonald's. It's crowded and people like, and I'm like little, there's two people following me, three people, four people. You're the guy in the Michael Jackson video. Oh shit. Oh yeah. So I had to stop and sign autograph, which had never happened for me before.
But that must have been cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's worldwide.
Yeah.
It's like, man, I've permeated the, vortex.
Now, I don't know how you would walk around New York back in the day, but obviously you weren't wearing a leather suit and was your hair wasn't all done up, or maybe it was.
I did that every day.
You did it every day. So you were easily recognizable then.
Dude, back then I'd go on vacation. I'd be on the beach in Jamaica and have the hair and the leather. I'd be on the beach with the leather pants. I'm not kidding you, man. I lived it, you know.
That's another thing that's cool about you and Billy on stage. You have this, you got the black hair, and thank goodness you both kept your hair because you need to be rock and roll. But you got the black hair and he's got the white hair and it just together, it's just a thing. I mean, it just immediately you're like, yeah, this is the real deal.
Yeah,
and that's even before you play, you just see a picture of you two guys and you're like, oh, look at these rock and rollers.
Yeah. And, well, the best compliment I think I ever got, we opened for The Who and this was probably about 6 or 7 years ago, and their manager, Bill Kerbish.
Yeah, yeah. Been around forever.
Yeah, and he came down the hallway and he pointed to me. He goes, now there's a rock star. And I thought, if the manager of The Who is saying that, I probably look like I should be playing on stage. You know? But yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, you're not going to get on stage with Billy Idol with a flannel shirt and a pair of moccasins.
Yeah.
You know, it just... You know, you have to rise to the occasion and be the guy's foil and, have that give and take. And, you know, that's I mean, since the days of Elvis and Scotty Moore and there's always been this singer and sidekick thing. And funnily enough, I remember when I was a kid and I was watching TV and 1968 Elvis comeback special, I was watching with my dad and I said, my mom was swooning over Elvis, mm-hmm. but I'm going to my dad. That's the guy I want to be. I want to be the guitar player that's
cool
right there, you know? And I think the classic guitar player thing, the Jimmy Pages and the Ritchie Blackmores and the Brian Mays were always a little bit quieter.
Yeah.
You know, always. And that fit my persona. You know, I couldn't imagine being on stage and being the front man. That's a really hard job, man. I've seen what that's about to do it right.
Right. Right.
You know, and I get to hide behind my instrument a little bit, you know, I'm speaking through something.
Yeah.
Whereas singers, you're really naked there and you're relying on a physical thing like a boxer.
You know,
what happens if your voice goes out or you have a cold or something?
Yeah.
So I have such respect for singers, man.
And
it's like,
and sometimes with Billy, he is almost naked because sometimes three songs in, the shirt's already off. I always thought about you guys, like, even though, like, you know, Plant and Page and Joe Perry and Steve Tyler and Mick and Keith, even though they're in bands and you are in, it's billed as Billy Idol, I still always felt that you guys were equals because, you know, you're on the back, you know, the pictures on the back, the album cover, it's you guys, you know what I'm saying? So even though it's under the umbrella of a of the name Billy Idol, I always felt like you two were like those other pairings. And it's just, that's what I like.
Yeah. I mean, in one respect, it's made things, look, the final word is Billy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's made things, you hear about all these bands fighting and all this kind of stuff. And that's a lot of that stuff where they sort of fight about the publishing and the
ego stuff.
And I think it's because it's Billy and it was his deal to begin with. Mm-hmm. You know, he had already done three records for Chris Liss, and there was it's definitely a direction, and he was very clear and specific about what he wanted the music to be like, what he felt the audience was waiting for, because he felt there was a real void between in America between punk rock stuff and rock stuff, which is what we kind of became, this middle ground. So he gave me a lot of direction and we helped develop stuff. So I think because of that, it's always been understood that, you know, I'm there and I'll give my opinion, and that's why I've lasted for so long, because
all these years.
Count on me. And I'll rehearse the band without him and do mm-hmm. all the stuff that maybe he doesn't want to be around for.
Yeah.
We very clearly know what our roles are.
And
we make it work.
And I meant that as a compliment. So I hope you don't, I don't take that as a slight. I'm totally kissing your butt on that. Okay.
Yeah. It's a relationship that, you know, it's much like a director and an actor, mm-hmm. you know.
Now, 1986, Top Gun Anthem. This is crazy success at this point. The soundtrack's number one on Billboard. It sells 9 million copies. It's the best-selling soundtrack of the year. And here we go. Harold Faltermeyer and Steve Stevens have this amazing instrumental.
This is a really good example of what I tell people, just say yes to things. When we were doing Whiplash Smile, Harold was the keyboard player. Harold was friends with Keith Forsey, our producer. They came up through the Giorgio Moroder studio scene together in Germany, did all those Donna Summers records. So Harold comes to New York, we're doing the record, and says to me, I want to play you something. We go in the lounge and he's got a little Betamax. It's the days of Betamax mm-hmm. video. Pops the Betamax in and it's some aerial footage, which, you know, from Top Gun, which at that time looked groundbreaking.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. Absolutely.
And says, oh, I'm scoring this movie. I'm in the middle of it. It's the Tom Cruise from Risky Business. Would you be interested in playing on it? Sure, you know. So I remember we did... We finished up our session with Idol on a Saturday at about 10 o'clock. And then Harold went and put the multi-track, the days of tape,
right.
You know, put the tape on the multi-track and had this theme. We proceeded to, you know, okay, we'll play the melody and da 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 and do all this. And And I think the whole session maybe took me 2 hours or something. And I kind of forgot, you know, I said, he goes, oh, there's a solo section. And I kind of, it was just the perfect fit, you
yeah.
know, I kind of forgot about it. And then he said, oh, the movie's going to premiere at the Ziegfeld in New York. Would you come to the premiere? Okay. You know, sure. I go, wow, this is a big deal. This is a big movie premiere. Movie comes out, it's got all these hits on it and stuff.
It's a massive success. I mean, because when you do it, you don't even know if the movie's going to be good or if people are going to like it. And it's just massive.
I had no idea, you know. And then he calls me from Germany. He says, we got nominated for a Grammy. And I go, yeah, well, you know, that's nice. And, you know, he goes, we're going to win. He's such a positive. He is the power of positive thinking is what Harold is all about.
And is that, did you guys win? Is that what you have the Grammy Award for?
We did win. We did.
Unbelievable.
And things, you know, sometimes things are just, you know, right. The Grammys that year were in Los Angeles. I was living in New York. So I would have had no intention of, you know, flying for them. But as luck would have it, Billy and I were performing on the Grammys that year. So I had to be in Los Angeles. So Harold says, well, that category is announced in the afternoon. Okay, I'll go down, you know, I'm sitting there and he's all like, we're going to win. Harold, I don't want this guy to be disappointed.
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
He's really expecting to win this thing. And I hate to be the sure shit. We end up winning. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. You know? It was more a validation for my parents that put up with that racket all those years.
Yeah.
To them, you know, a Grammy is you know, it's, you know, I gave my mom and dad my first gold record and those kind of things. I don't display them or, you know, things. It's a nice indicator, but, I prescribe to the notion that, you know, you're only as good as your next song or record.
Right.
So, but it was great validation for them.
Steve, you're a very humble guy. I mean, I didn't know what you would be like. I didn't think you would be a jerk or anything like that. But you're a very, very humble and good dude. And this is fun.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, I don't think you really get to experience and find real joy in what you do without being a little bit humble.
Yeah.
Because you don't get to really meet people and you don't. I mean, you know, maybe back in the 80s, I was a little bit cocky and I certainly wasn't as thoughtful towards people because obviously I was always Billy's musical director. Mm-hmm. And now I'm a little bit more careful about how I treat people and how I really value my friendships with people. And, you know, look, I've been doing this a long time. If I don't have fun doing it,
right,
you know, it's
then why do it?
I'm so fortunate to make music as my living, you know. So what do I have to be an asshole about?
That's what I always say. I'm like, why is that guy an asshole? He's doing what he set out to do.
There ain't no reason in the world. I got a wonderful wife who travels with me. And, you know, man, and I always tell people, you learn from your mistakes. And for many years, I wasn't in the moment. Mm-hmm. Put it that way. And now I'm grateful for all the experiences and all the,
that's great.
You know, look, I get to meet somebody like Butch Walker and make music with this guy who's like, you know, I've been doing this, you know, for however many years, making records for 40 years.
Yeah.
And
it's a gift.
And now to work with somebody new with new energy and new ideas. And also guys, he's, same thing, sweetheart, you know, and it was just like that's how you would hope the business would be.
Now I'm going to talk about some people you worked with that I had no idea you worked with these people, and or if I did, I forgot about it. Rick Ocasek,
yeah,
you played on his second solo album, This Side of Paradise. On paper, I wouldn't put you two guys together. How did this come about? Almost all my questions are like, how did this happen? But I mean, seriously, this is so cool to me. And again, I listened to this album the other night and I'm like, of course that's fucking Steve Stevens. This is unbelievable that I didn't know about this.
It's just one of those, New York had such a great recording scene happening. And I think Rick was also over at Electric Lady Recording. And, what was great is, and the guy's name is escaping me, but the producer, Chris something or other.
Chris Hughes?
Maybe.
I think it's...
And he was the producer for Tears for Fears, did all those incredible... Shout and Everyone Wants It.
Everybody Wants to Rule the World. Yeah.
Rule the World. And those records were, even back then, they sounded amazing. They still sound great.
Yeah.
So he was the one that called me, and I jumped at the chance to work with him. So...
You play on 6 of the 10 songs.
I did, yeah. And the funniest thing was, so I go in the studio and we start tracking and I'm getting set up, whatever. And Rick says to this girl, Steve, would you like anything? I said, a cup of coffee be great, a little cream and sugar. Says to this girl, oh, would you get Steve a cup of coffee? Okay, great. It's Paulina. I'm like, oh my God, it's Paulina.
She's getting you some coffee.
Some coffee, but they were great people. They were great. Rick was, it was like working with Spock.
I understand.
Smart.
Yeah, I understand what you mean.
He was so smart we bonded over. Rick had actually produced Suicide, which was a really influential duo out of New York. Alan Vega was a singer, and they were really influential. They actually, Billy turned me on to them, and we had them open for us on a big show. And I bonded with him because he produced it and gave them exposure. And I said, man, that Suicide record is a big one for me. And
He had a lot of great producing credits with the D-Generation and Weezer and No Doubt. I mean,
really
pretty amazing
guy.
Stuff. Yeah.
Really smart guy and fun to work with. Yeah.
And the song Keep On Laughing has a killer guitar solo from you.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't listened to that in a long time, but, I'm so sad when he passed away. Mm-hmm. He was a really unique person, really unique.
Moving on from that, 1990, you work with Robert Palmer on this album, Don't Explain. I mean, Robert Palmer, he worked with Andy Taylor in Power Station. And this is another collaboration that... that seems out of the ordinary for me. And it just, it works. It's so good. The song You're Amazing. And that video, you're pretty much almost front and center in that video. You know what I mean? We're in paradise, baby, darling.
The crazy thing is I had known Robert before I knew Billy Idol. the band I was in before Idol, I had mentioned we went out to the Bahamas to record our record, which was never released. And we're at the studio, and Robert lived across the street from the studio and just walks in with a, you know, bottle of tequila or something. Says hello, you know, and we're all like, is that Rob? That's Robert Palmer. And he goes, he's hearing, you know, we're playing some tracks or something. And he goes, oh, who's the guitar player? I was like, that would be me. He said, well, I live across the street. I'm writing some demo. You know, I'm working on some demos. Would you come over and help me work out some demos? So we became friends then. And when he'd come through New York, he would call me and we'd go guitar shopping. He wanted to buy some guitars and I knew all the music stores, cool, and take them around. And we maintained a friendship all throughout the Billy Idol stuff. And then when I recorded with him, now here was the ultimate Robert Palmer, because he was living in Milan in Italy, the fashion capital of the world.
Sure.
I'm with Robert Palmer. And he takes me to buy a Versace suit. and he takes me to this hotel, which he says, this hotel makes the best martini in the world. And I go, oh, that's good. He goes, no, I mean it. He goes, this is the best martini in the world. So we proceeded to get absolutely shit-faced in Milan, Italy. And you know, it was just exactly how you would hope Robert Palmer.
Yeah, that sounds like exactly how I would think that he would be, a man of the world.
And first class. Everything about it was first class.
And I feel bad that we're talking about so many people today that have passed on.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. But let's touch on some guys that are still with us. And so funny, you read this list, these next two guys are guys that you think might not still be with us, but they still are, Vince Neil and Sebastian Bach.
Yeah.
So Vince Neil, you work with Ron Nevison on the Exposed album. This is right. He's no longer in Motley at this point. You're not working with Billy at this point. So this seems like a good pairing. Put you good two guys together and see what happens.
I mean, actually doing the album was great, because I was used, first of all, I was used to working on records that were, you know, guitar solos were a little more economical. So you get 8 bars, you know, at very Atomic Playboys, 16 bars maybe. And now I'm working with Vince and working on, you know, we're in the studio arranging the songs and make the guitar solo longer. Okay, no longer, you know, 32 bars, 64 bars guitar. So, you know, play as loud and as fast as possible. And also, we had already been booked to open for Van Halen for that tour. So, and I had become friends with Ed. And so it was fun doing the record. The thing was, just right at that time is when grunge hit. And,
yeah.
Anything that was associated with excessive 80s stuff, it didn't matter who you were. It was just looked at as old hat. And,
right.
So although the Van Halen tour was great, after that, you know, we're starting to play smaller venues and stuff. And the writing was on the wall for a bit, you know.
There was going to be a little break from this type of music for a while.
Yeah. I mean, and unfortunately for me, it was the height of the excess. You know, I was on the road with Eddie Van Halen. We were partying and I couldn't play louder. I couldn't play faster. I could, you know, and I had gotten off the road from Vince. I had actually left under not great circumstances. And I'm in Los Angeles and I go see Paco de Lucía, the famous flamenco guitar player. I had started when I was a kid. One of my first guitar teachers was a flamenco guitarist, and Paco was at the Wiltern, and it was 3,000 people, and they were still going crazy, and he was playing all this blindingly fast guitar. And I went, well, that if I reconnect with that side of my playing, it's a way for me to be virtuoso,
right?
But not a kind of music where people feel like they have to hold up scorecards or something.
Right.
So I put my electric guitar down for a year and did a flamenco record.
And when you make a record like that, did you do any flamenco shows anywhere?
I did, actually. Yeah. I mean, the cool thing about it was also at that time I got sober and it was all part of like a cleansing thing. And I cleared out a lot of like bad people in my life and had this renewed love of playing guitar. So I went to Europe and I went to France and England, and I just traveled around with this flamenco guitar, writing songs and doing tracks with people, and then ended up finishing the record in Hawaii with David Tickle, who mixed it. And it was just all part of my renewed energy about this love of guitar. And it's that record was an important step for me because that has stayed with me during the course of a Billy Idol show. I do a flamenco guitar solo.
Yeah.
And we've added touches of it to some of our music. I still get to play that with, I have some friends of mine who play flamenco, guitarists and stuff. So it was an important record for me.
I would imagine sitting around with guys that can also play that style of music and just, it's a different kind of a jamming, but it's probably super satisfying.
So satisfying, yeah. And it's like I'm a pick guitar player. Mm-hmm. I don't play with flamenco with my fingers. So when I'm across from like my friend Ben Woods, who's my usual partner with flamenco, I'm like anybody else. I'm a fan. I'm looking at what he's doing with the traditional thing, and he's looking at what I'm able to do with the pick. And we're just like, man, we're just mutual respect there.
So you never stop learning, then, is what you're telling me.
Never.
2014, Sebastian Bach, Give 'Em Hell. You co-write three songs on this: Push Away, Had Enough, and this killer Gun to a Knife Fight is just amazing. And Sebastian Bach can still sing his ass off.
Yeah, I mean, he's But the funniest, I had befriended him with, there's a an all-star group called Royal Machines here in Los Angeles. So they have different guest singers, and Dave Navarro is usually the guitar player in that. But when he was shooting his TV show, I filled in. So one of the singers who guested was Sebastian. And, I really liked that Slave to the Grind record.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a great Skid Row album.
So I suggested a couple of songs off that. And he's, you know, he'd lived in New Jersey, and you know, we kind of struck up a thing, and he said, hey, you know, I'm working on a new record. Would you like to write some tunes for it? And that's really how it came about. But the first funny thing was the first gig, I said I was booked to play at the Iridium in New York, which is where Les Paul did his weekly show. Originally, it was at a really small place called Fat Tuesdays. Then they moved it there, and they kept, after Les Paul passed away, they kept his, whatever it was, Tuesday night gig, and they'd have different guitar players come in. So I was asked to do it, and I said, Sebastian, you want to come with me to New York? We'll do this thing at the Iridium. Okay, cool. Then we realize it's like dinner theater. People are sitting at tables eating their dinner, and there's fucking 6'3" Sebastian walking on their dinner table, picking up their chicken. And, oh, what do you got? Pork chop? It was fun. I mean, I was thinking, oh my God, he's gonna hate this, and he was really a good sport about it. He's over the top. He's a rock star through and through, but he's such a huge rock music fan, you know?
Yeah.
And when you get down to it, that's really where he's at. He really does love rock and roll, and he is a larger than life character.
Well, I met him in person earlier this year before the whole COVID thing happened. It was at this Ronnie James Dio event at the Avalon, and I'm there with my friend, and we see Sebastian Bach, and I'm like, man, I really want to talk to Sebastian Bach. And we took so much because we didn't want to bother him. You know how that, you know, that's how a fan feels. But man, he was so nice when we approached him.
Good.
He just,
good.
He just talked. You know, he would have talked for as long as we wanted to talk, but you know, we let him go. Yeah, he was super cool. Super cool.
Yeah, great, great.
Now, the most recent music you've done, is it this Deadland Ritual?
Right, yeah. COVID kind of put a
stop on some things.
On progress on that, but that was, you know, project that was Frankie Perez, myself, Matt Sorum, and Geezer Butler.
So a super group is what we call this.
Yeah, we don't.
You guys don't, but that's what we would call it.
Look, the bottom line is you can pick all these names or whatever, but until you get in a room together, you don't know.
You don't know if it's super.
You don't know if it's, you know, going to be if the chemistry's there or not. Or, but we went and we did two tours. We toured in Europe and we've played some dates, and all the material is written. All the songs are written, and the original plan was I was going to finish with Idol in Vegas doing our residency around March, April or May. We were going to go in and record. And right now it's on the, cause that's one of those bands that it's not like a Butch Walker, Billy Idol thing.
Yeah.
That's, you have to employ lots of engineers, and there's a lot of people to move the moving parts with management and all this kind of stuff. And, I hope it'll see the light of day.
And some of the song, a couple of tracks are out there to get, you can get Down in Flames and Broken and Bruised. You can go download those tracks.
Absolutely.
When you do the Vegas residency, is that, for someone that's toured the world and you know what it's like to wake up early and get on a plane and do all this stuff, is that kind of a really chill way to do it? Do you like it, would you rather be city to city?
I love it. I mean, because the crazy thing is you have people that fly in from,
right.
from everywhere in the world, from Japan, South America. I mean, we do 3 days a week, so you don't want to play the same songs every night. So mm-hmm. it gives us an opportunity to really dig into the back catalog. And now with a lot of these things that we did in the '80s, we really couldn't bring to fruition on stage because the technology wasn't there. So now with all the things that are available, we're able to go back and do some of the older songs and really do them justice and kind of interject a new flavor, kind of modern approach to it. And also for our road crew, you know, seeing a road crew that doesn't have to break down every
night. Right. I think would be amazing.
Those guys are, you know, it's great.
They get to finally have a little fun.
They do. And we're a tight knit group of people, mm-hmm. you know, with, including the road crew, who some of which have been with us 10, 15 years. And, you know, there's a lot of social stuff. We'd get to dinners and go check out things in Vegas,
nice.
Shows or whatever. So it's a great situation. Yeah.
So I see I've gone over my time with you, Steve. I got just a couple more questions if you can hang.
Absolutely. Yeah.
2005, Devil's Playground. You guys, you and Billy get back together.
In the Devil's Playground with an idle mind. Straight up, ready to go. Announce the time. Does he still have the magic? Yes, he does. He'll be famous just because. Just because. You have to change your mind sometimes. Yeah, you're gonna have to turn around. Ride my rocket.
We had already been back together.
You were touring.
We had done dates. When I first got back together with Billy, which was, I think, 93 or so, he was still signed to Chrysalis Records. Chrysalis folded. He got shifted over to Capitol. There was an ill-fated record that we did with Glenn Ballard, I think, was Alanis Morissette's producer, which was like an all-acoustic thing. It just didn't work. It just, you know, was. And then, you know, it took us a while. And then the whole, throughout the 90s, even though we played and gigged, it was, you know, a time of like, you know, we don't have to put out music right now,
right.
because we don't know exactly where we want to go. And but the thing that really solidified a lot of things was when we did VH1 Storytellers, because that was a way for Billy and I to look at our back catalog, maybe do it in a different way.
Absolutely.
There was a couple of flamenco, you know, we did Don't Need a Gun flamenco style. And
so cold, it echoes in blue. All those twisting tongues, they are after you. Wow.
So we had already been working together and touring when we did Devil's Playground.
It's a killer record. And you co-wrote three songs, three of my favorites, including Romeo's Waiting and Summer Running. I love those. And Rat
Summer
Race.
Summer Running, yeah. Rat Race was the one for me that I, and playing that live was, that was one of those songs that really had its own atmosphere and vibe about it, yeah.
Wake me from my sleep. A cautionary tale, walking infancy, a way to derail. I wanted to be free, and I wanted only you. The walls are falling down, and somebody says,
All right, let's wrap up with asking you. I got to ask about the ray gun. When did the ray gun start?
So if people don't know, I on the Rebel Yell solo, I use a toy ray gun. It's actually an effect with it, but when we did Rebel, I'll try and make this a short story.
Yeah, you can tell it however long as you want to tell it, Steve. I'm in no hurry to leave.
So Rebel Yell, we realized this is going to be the title track of the album. This is the opening track. It's got a bit of a guitar solo in it, but it can't just be notes, you know. I thought, and the backing track was so storming. It was like I wasn't going to put one thing on there that wasn't appropriate. And I brought in, it was my idea that yeah, it could be guitar solo, but we needed something that was going to absolutely take people's heads off right when they heard it. Like, what the hell is that? You know? So I brought in this Billy Cobham record, which had Tommy Bolin on it. And there's a song on there called Quadrant 4. And Tommy Bolin, brilliant guitar player. At one point, he has this guitar oscillating feedback with an echo machine. And I played it for our producer. I said, we need something like that, but not that. And we're like banging our heads, trying to, you know, we'd get the guitar solo. And then I'm at home and I was living in the basement of my parents' house, and I've got the guitar. I'm laying in the bed. I got the guitar. I had a little practice amp. And I used to collect these little toys, you know, little robots and things. I got this little ray gun, and I'm playing. And I, what the hell? It's coming through the guitar. And I go closer and I put it by the pickup, and it's this ray gun sound.
Wow.
Wow, that's cool.
So a happy accident.
A totally happy accident. But then I'm like, but it'd be good if it like sped up and did this whole thing. So I open it up and I have a little bit of an electronics background. I'm good at tinkering, you know. So I start looking at where the resistors are, and I go, I don't know. I knew enough to know that if I vary a resistor with a potentiometer and mount it, I can actually play this thing through the guitar. And hence, that's the ray gun. Yeah, you practice guitar for 60 years, and the thing people want to know about
is the toy. Is the toy that you touch to the pickups? Yeah. But on your website though, we can buy a ray gun.
Yeah, there's a very specific one that has to be, if it's going to be like the ones that I use on stage. They're from the 70s. The newer ones you can't really tinker with. So we sell ones for like $25 that are just like, it's like signing a photo of something for something. But what I did is I uncovered recently about 25 of these brand new, but from the 70s ray guns. And I personally altered them and put the switches in and everything. And I made them available.
That's cool.
To fans. And they sold out in like one day. And I was thinking, no, I don't know if people are going to want this because, you know, I got to charge something because I'm in there soldering. There's a lot of man hours and doing this. One day they were gone.
They're gone. And then you're thinking, oh, I should have charged more.
No, I was glad to.
No, I'm kidding. I know. I'm joking.
You know, I was glad to put them in people's hands. But here's the messed up thing. I've gone to three different effects companies.
Okay.
With this idea.
Yeah.
To manufacture this because it could be a very inexpensive thing. And people obviously want it. And none of them.
No one wants to do it.
Particularly interested.
That's weird.
So if anybody hears this.
Yeah, if anyone's listening and you want to invest in some Steve Stevens stuff.
I'm telling you, we'd sell a boatload of these.
The ones you had, you sold out immediately. So who wouldn't want to do it?
Absolutely.
Steve, again, you got a lot of stuff happening. SteveStevensGuitar.com. On Twitter, you're @SteveStevens. On Cameo, cameo.com/ Steve Stevens at Go-Go, and you're going to be teaching a master class.
Yeah, for
Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp.
Yeah, this is the second one I'll be doing. The first one was great. It was great. It was really, you know, like I said, if when I was a kid and I could have logged into Zoom and had, you know, personal audience or, you know, dialogue with Jimmy Page or Ritchie Blackmore, right, or anybody, it would have meant so much to me. And I really value it. And I get something back from it because it reminds me of when I first started playing, yeah, the instrument, you know, and it's a great experience. I love doing it.
Well, it's kind of the same thing for me, Steve, when, you know, I'm a grown man now, but in 1982, if I could have had a Zoom conversation with Steve Stevens, my head would have exploded. You know, it's exploding now, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. If I can't pass on some of this knowledge, and the knowledge that I have is only because I've made that many mistakes.
Well, that's so how you learn.
If I could save somebody from blowing up their amplifier or ruining a guitar, you know, I'll pass it on.
Well, there's lots of stuff on the horizon from Steve Stevens. Steve, thank you so much for giving me this time today. I hope when you guys come through Los Angeles that if I reach out, I'll get to come say hi.
Oh, that'd be great. Absolutely.
So, Steve, continue to quarantine. Say hello to your lovely wife for me.
Will do.
And Steve, I play out with a play out song. What Steve Stevens song would you like me to play out on? I know it's hard because you've played on so many tracks, but do you have one in mind?
Yeah, you know, the Atomic Playboys is a song called Crackdown. And I believe it's the best song on that record. So if you want to play Crackdown,
I will play Crackdown.
It's really encapsulates a lot of what I'm about as a guitar player.
Excellent.